travel forward with us, 300 years into the future, to confront the greatest mystery ever to threaten mankind. We are aboard a huge starship called the Enterprise.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is Star Trek the Motion Picture, Star Trek II the Wrath of Khan, and Star Trek III the Search for Spock. And here to discuss those three classic sci-fi movies with me is Jim Yelton. Welcome aboard the show, Jim.
Thanks for having me back, man.
And this is going to be, and Jim's one of my absolute favorite guests. I'm so glad to have him on here to talk about something that we're both, it's near and dear to our hearts. Our plan right now is that we're going to talk about all six today, and we'll divide this up into two episodes. And so in this first episode, we're going to hit the first three, obviously, and probably do about 15 minutes per movie, and I'll have some other extras stuck in there during post-production. So let's Jim, kind of tell folks who you are that haven't heard your previous appearances, just what you do and why you're here.
You know, it's funny because I just had to do this like 2 days ago. I am a writer. I've written novels, screenplays, radio theater. I've acted on stage. I've directed 10 stage productions. I just finished directing Sherlock Holmes, The Final Adventure, over the fall.
Awesome.
And I write science fiction. I write superhero action adventure drama, which is kind of in your wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. And have just been a huge fan of the genre since I was a kid. And I am currently in the midst of teaching a screenwriting class. So you're going to get a lot of in-depth, you know, inside baseball screenwriting stuff from me when we talk about some of this stuff.
Excellent. Excellent. Very glad to hear it. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. I knew you'd bring that to the table. So meanwhile, I don't bring a lot except, well, that was cool. But we'll see what I can do. All right. So let us not waste any time then, because we got a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Let's jump right in. Now, let's set the stage a little bit before we get into the first movie. What had happened, of course, was that Star Trek was on NBC as a TV show from 66 through 1969. And, you know, as I always say, it back then they didn't narrow cast, they broadcast, as they say on the Howard Stern movie. And so the ratings were not great, but when, you know, you go back and look at the Star Trek TV ratings by demographics, you know, today from the late 60s, from the information we have, it was like, you know, the perfect demographics, the ratings, it would have never gone off the air. You know, it was the exact demographic of young people with money, you know, that spend money on stuff that the networks want to reach. So they didn't understand that in the late 60s, and so it got canceled. And tell us what sort of happened to it during the 70s.
Well, you know, Star Trek has always been like the poster child for what a passionate fan base can do to keep a show alive or keep some sort of franchise going after the fact. Because obviously, I mean, you and I are kind of like poster children for having watched it in syndication, because mm-hmm. syndication was still a big deal in the early 70s. And when the three seasons of Star Trek went into syndication, it kind of exploded because it was on, you know, five nights a week. And it was on, you know, earlier in the evening, which is, like you said, like that demographic, that young demographic was home watching TV in the early evening, and they just sucked it up. And then conventions were kind of in their infancy, so people started going to conventions and talking about Star Trek a lot. And that's when you had the stereotypical Trekkie kind of born, where they were starting to go in costume and really make a big deal about this show that barely lasted three seasons before being canceled. And the interesting thing is that Paramount Pictures, who then owned the franchise at the time, kind of took notice of it and said, wow, there's a lot of people that like the Star Trek thing. Mm-hmm. We've got to be able to monetize that somehow. And they had been talking for years about doing their own network. You know, this was back in the days where it was pretty much just ABC, CBS, NBC. Mm-hmm. And a lot of different studios and a lot of different companies had talked about maybe launching a fourth network to compete with those big three. And Paramount was one of those people, and they had decided that they were going to use Star Trek to kind of anchor one night of programming, that if they could kind of capture the zeitgeist again with Star Trek and get all of these young people watching their network for one night, they knew they had a sure thing.
Mm-hmm. And you could argue that Star Trek was it's arguably the first sort of space adventure science fiction show that was completely grown up in its attitudes and its approaches, that had sort of a geopolitics going on. I mean, Lost in Space is all well and good, but it wasn't about this giant confrontation between essentially the United States, the Soviet Union, and China, you know, and the UN and everything. I mean, plus there was all the stuff that Star Trek is famous for that it did with regard to, like, civil rights and being metaphorical for race relations and all this sort of thing, you know. So it broke a lot of ground in those ways.
And I think, you know, over the years, Gene Roddenberry takes a lot of crap from Star Trek fans for, you know, kind of ruling over Star Trek with an iron fist while he had control of it. But the man was a visionary as far as the format of the show, the kinds of stories that he wanted to tell, the fact that he went out and got, you know, some of the leading science fiction writers of the time to write for his show. And really, like you said, I mean, kind of took it seriously and didn't kind of downplay it and wasn't gearing it towards kids, and really just said, you know, I'm going to do an adult science fiction show, and, you know, people are going to like it or they're not going to like it.
And ironically, while he's out trying to get these big writers, it turned out that one of the best writers was like his secretary, Dorothy Fontana. So, and she cranked out several great ones. So, okay. So, They decided to make what they called Star Trek Phase 2, which gets into what you were sort of alluding to there. But then eventually that sort of falls through, and they decided to just go ahead. I think it's after probably – do you know that for sure about this? Because I can't remember. Was it the success of Star Wars, as with everything else in entertainment? Was it the success of Star Wars that made them decide to go big-budget motion picture as opposed to TV show?
Yeah, because I want to say that the development of Star Trek Phase 2 for television mm-hmm. – was going on around 75, 76.
Yeah.
And to the point where a lot of the sets that they used for the first movie were actual sets for the TV show and costumes and things like that. And they had already talked to all of the cast about coming back. In fact, Nimoy famously turned them down mm-hmm. and was initially, if I remember correctly, he was going to appear in the premiere episode of the show – to kind of pass the torch to the whatever new Vulcan they were going to have on the show. Mm-hmm. But he was not going to be involved in the show proper once it kind of launched. But everybody else was. And then Star Wars hit. And, you know, the heads of Paramount, in their infinite wisdom, said, wow, we can make a lot more money if we make this into a movie instead of a TV show. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of where they said, okay, let's pump the brakes here on doing the TV show. Mm-hmm. And let's think a little bit bigger and a little bit more epic and let's do a movie.
Travel forward with us, 300 years into the future, to confront the greatest mystery ever to threaten mankind. We are aboard a huge starship called the Enterprise. This is the return of Captain Kirk.
An alien object of unbelievable destructive power is less than 3 days away from this planet.
Mr. Spock.
I offer my services as science officer.
Dr. McCoy. Scotty. And joining them on their mission, Commander Will Decker and Navigator Ilea.
I'm sorry.
That you left Delta 4? Or that you didn't even say goodbye?
Get us back in impulse power. Full reverse.
Wormhole distortion has overloaded the main power systems. The late phaser order.
This, then, is the epic journey of the Starship Enterprise, traveling to the outer limits of time and space to challenge a vast, living machine of destruction. The human adventure is just beginning. Star Trek, the motion picture.
A Gene Roddenberry production, a Robert Wise film.
And so what we ended up with, they brought in Robert Wise, who I believe famously had directed The Day the Earth Stood Still, to direct a script that was more or less... Alan, was it not an Alan Dean Foster?
Alan Dean Foster,
yeah. He was script with Roddenberry having some input. It kind of combined ideas from The Changeling and The Ultimate Computer and a couple of other earlier episodes, which is interesting because Star Trek II kind of touches on earlier episodes too. But it sort of combines this idea of a man-made object that comes back to Earth and has sort of its own agenda now and is misunderstood and is insanely powerful and everything. And so what we end up with is Star Trek, the motion picture. And it was presented and marketed to the public as, you know, just this event, this huge thing. I remember seeing like features on 2020 on ABC, the news magazine show about it. They said, you know, 20 million fans can't be wrong. Star Trek is back, you know, and they really did make a big publicity push. It hit right around Christmas, I believe, of 1979.
Yeah.
And it had huge opening numbers. We'll talk about the movie itself in a second, but while we're still talking about sort of the, you know, the surrounding situation, it had huge opening numbers and did pretty well. But I think ultimately the consensus on it, now this is not true of necessarily everybody, but the consensus of the reviewers and much of the public, and especially the public in the wake of Star Wars, where science fiction movie meant shoot 'em up, excitement, pulp, action, adventure, science fantasy, that's never what Star Trek was really trying to be. And, you know, Star Trek tries to put the science in science fiction to a certain degree. They try to be the thinking man's science fiction and not the action science fiction, although, again, there is some bleed over. And so it did pretty well, but the general consensus seemed to be that it was somewhat disappointing because it was a rather slow movie, and not quite, you know, it's surrounded by Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark and things like that. And so, you know, by comparison, it does seem a lot slower. Now, I got to say, the humorous thing about saying by comparison it seems slower and not quite as exciting is that on the movie posters of Star Trek the Motion Picture, they actually had the tagline, "There is no comparison." And, right. and unfortunately, the public passed their verdict and said, yes, you're right. We want Star Wars. And so Star Trek the Motion Picture sort of fizzled out. And for a while, it looked like that would be the end of it as far as a movie. In fact, I remember I got to jump ahead for just a second here while we're talking still about the meta. The first I ever heard of Star Trek II, the first I ever knew Star Trek II existed was I saw a movie poster, preview poster of it at a theater. Had no idea it was coming. I don't know how it got under my radar, but for some reason I had no idea they were making another Star Trek movie. And I saw an early preview poster at the theater. And I remember to this day my instant reaction was, they made a sequel to that? So what do you remember in terms of Star Trek the Motion Picture coming out and reaction to it and how its reception was and everything?
Well, and you know, the funny thing is, like you said, I mean, we're talking about late 70s, early 80s when the first couple of movies came out. And so there wasn't the internet with,
yeah,
you know, 2 years of lead time about what the story is going to be about and who's going to be in it and, you know, showing concept artwork and things like that. I mean, I remember knowing about Star Trek the Motion Picture when the advertising started to kick in and, you know, seeing things on TV and what have you. But until I got older and more started coming out about the Star Trek Phase 2 television series and, you know, the failed attempt to bring it back that way, I had no idea that that happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a kid growing up, mm-hmm. it was just Star Trek was on TV in reruns, and then all of a sudden they wanted to make this movie, mm-hmm. and it did seem like we're cashing in on Star Wars, mm-hmm. and it just seemed odd because I remember seeing the advertising and the build up to it, and it was just kind of like Star Trek's not Star Wars,
right?
And you know what makes Star Trek great is completely diametrically opposed to what makes Star Wars great. And I don't know how those things are going to mesh if they're trying to make a movie to compete with Star Wars. And like you said, I think there was a general disappointment at the time about the movie because it wasn't Star Wars. Right. And they were trying to sell it as something similar to Star Wars. And, you know, it was never intended to be that. And I think it's interesting because they had this pilot script for this failed TV show that they were going to launch, and they had to shoehorn that into a movie. And storytelling in television is completely different than movie storytelling. And I think they were going a little bit more cerebral than they should have for a first movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought it was interesting seeing that first attempt at Star Trek on the big screen that – especially like you said, with Robert Wise directing it, who directed, you know, one of the all time great cerebral science fiction movies.
Yeah.
You know, they were taking him in this very thought provoking cerebral script that they had and saying, make Star Wars with Captain Kirk and Spock.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't exactly like they brought in Spielberg or Hal Needham, you know, or something.
Right, exactly.
This was the deep thinking. Now let me say, because I'm trying to be very careful how we lay this particular movie out. I'm giving kind of the reaction at the time, and that's what we're talking about right now. My opinion of it has changed dramatically over the years.
So is mine, yeah.
Okay. But again, so it comes out, and again, to speak about how I felt about it then, this was a movie where the guns are only fired one time, and that's against a rock in the wormhole.
Yes. You know,
they're going to shoot the phasers, and then they're like, oh, don't shoot the phasers. Good God, man, that'll kill us all or something. Shoot the photon torpedo. Okay, so they shoot one photon torpedo. There's your shoot 'em up. Okay. The other thing was they had those cool. You know, one of the things people loved about the original series was the costumes, the uniforms, and they completely threw that out the window and had these basically Space 1999 pajamas. Now,
they would have been the best pajamas for kids at the time.
Oh yeah. Now, God bless Space 1999, one of my favorite things, but that's not really the look you want for Star Trek. And so it just was so weird that they suddenly had gone from this sort of cool action man, black pants and black boots and colored long sleeve shirt, to this sort of, it almost looked like they'd gone backwards to the 50s with the sort of like a psychedelic pajamas, bell bottoms, you know, silky. And so that just kind of rubbed at least me the wrong way, that suddenly they were dressing like, and the whole thing where the ship was just untouchable. It was like the ship was made out of glass. Everything was so nice. We had just seen Star Wars, which had been this revelation that you could make everything dirty and beat up. People today don't understand that Star Wars was really one of, if not the first, you know, science fictional space type shows, movies, where the hardware looked like it had been used and was beaten up and dirty and rusty.
And it had a very lived-in look to it.
Yeah, and then here comes Star Trek, which looks like a floating, like a cruise ship. It looks like the Pacific Princess or something, where they're constantly polishing the railing, you know. And so that, too, was kind of jarring. Again, I don't mean to say that it has to be like Star Wars, but I think that there was some degree of that in people's minds back then. And so it by making it so sterile and so precious, you know, you couldn't, you know, they never take a hit. It's never bumped into, even much less, you know, shot or anything. That's why Star Trek II was such a jarring, you know, revelation when it came out. It was quite the opposite. So it's like they took a hammer to it after the first movie. So I guess my point is there were so many things about it, and there wasn't a lot of action. It was talking and resolving things through intelligence and through communication and persuading, you know, as opposed to running and jumping and shooting. Now, again, I don't mean that in a negative way now. I mean that in the sense of it wasn't, I think, what an audience wanted from a big-budget science fiction movie in 1979. Would you agree with that?
Oh, most definitely. And I've even said, you know, I don't know if it was Robert Wise specifically or if it was kind of like a brain trust of people that were making decisions about how to cut together the final edit. But, you know, everybody knows there's these long, laborious shots of, you know, the Enterprise, you know, from the time Kirk leaves the space dock with Scotty until they actually get to the Enterprise. You know, they got to take a whole 360 degree trip around the Enterprise.
While the camera makes love to the Enterprise. Maybe.
Exactly. And there's also, you know, the same sorts of shots when they finally find V'ger and they go through the cloud.
Yes.
And, you know, they see, find this massive ship on the inside of it. And I've said for the longest time, I know it would be a much shorter movie, but I think you could trim probably 20, 25 minutes out of that movie and make it a really good movie that would have the action feel to it without the action.
Well,
if that makes sense. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things I constantly tell people whenever I conduct a seminar or a class is, you know, there has to be action. There has to be something happening in a scene to propel the plot forward. And there's huge chunks of Star Trek, the motion picture where there's nothing really going on other than the ship is slowly going through something.
We're watching them watch the screen.
Exactly. And, you know, that's where I think a lot of people's feelings that it's not an action movie come from is that, you know, Robert Wise just fell in love with all of these models that they had and all of the effects that they could do. So let's just show it for 15 minutes before we get to the next scene.
Well, several things about that. I think you're absolutely right. My buddy Keith DeCandido, who's written a number of Star Trek novels, he likes to call this one Star Trek, the motionless picture. And I understand that. And it was sort of funny that when they released it for television, for network TV, part of the hype was that they'd added like 20 more minutes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And my reaction was like, added 20 minutes. Good God, what? I thought they would say subtracted, but you know, I have.
Well, normally when something like that happens, you do kind of get excited because you say to yourself, oh, there's scenes that were cut out. You know, there's more stuff going on that we didn't get in the theatrical release. But when they said they added stuff, what they added was 5 more minutes of the V'ger cloud or 5 more minutes of the shuttle going around the Enterprise at the beginning of the movie. I mean, it was like, okay, we already saw that. Like, we don't need that again.
Well, now I have to point out they did put out a revised version, like deluxe director's cut version, a few years ago, which I have, and I love it because it's shorter, and they updated all the special effects all the way through it, which helps. And one of the main and they do kind of make it a little bit more concise, moving through the cloud and everything. So it's right. It's a much better movie. The director's cut or whatever, it's a much
It is.
Better movie. Also, the special effects house that did the V'ger cloud and everything, it's just was a mess. It just was like a blue, cloudy, fuzzy thing. And even when the Enterprise went inside and you were supposed to be seeing these structures and these vast interior things, it's just a muddled blue and black mess mostly on the screen. And they've redone a good bit of that so you can actually see, you know, the inside of V'ger a bit better. And so I would beseech anybody who has never seen this movie in the director's cut version, give it one more chance with that DVD, because it's still Star Trek the Motion Picture. It's not like they changed the story, but it has better pacing, it's more concise, and I can't tell you how much the updated special effects inside V'ger, you know, if you've got to watch the Enterprise moving through V'ger, at least it helps to see what's going on, you know.
Exactly.
You couldn't see anything in the original version. It was just a mess. So, okay. So all that being said, what is your view of this movie today? How has it changed?
Well, you know, one of the things that I look back and when I've watched it, you know, recently, I think to myself, this is a really good episode of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And it does exactly what the best episodes of Star Trek did in the past. You know, it makes you think, it presents a moral dilemma for the crew to solve. It concentrates on the Kirk, Spock, McCoy triumvirate. And, you know, I think we talked about this when we talked about the Abrams updated movies, that the one thing that was lacking from those was the very definition of why Kirk and Spock and McCoy work as, you know, different points of a triangle, because you've got Spock who represents logic and McCoy who represents emotion and Kirk is in between. Mm. And that the moral dilemma is always he's the captain having to decide how to combine logic and emotion and solve whatever the problem is. And so I always think, looking at it now in a more adult frame of mind, that it does that as well as any of the best episodes of the series did. You know, you have V'ger, you have, you know, when they have the Ilea probe that is sent back from V'ger, you know, they have to deal with her. They're trying to communicate with, you know, this being that can destroy the planet, and, you know, they're in a race against time to make that happen. So, you know, it really works for me story wise, even if the effects don't work, or even if, you know, Robert Wise's direction doesn't work for me. I mean, it is a really good Star Trek story.
Yeah. What I like about it is that alone out of the entire 6 of them, to one degree or another, it's a science fiction movie. It's not trying to be a science fantasy movie. It's not trying to be anything other than it's a science fiction movie in the way that, like, 2010 is a science fiction movie, or Contact is a science fiction movie, or 2001. And that's what Star Trek is supposed to be. It's like you say, it's supposed to be a thing that makes you think. You're not supposed to check your brain at the door to enjoy Star Trek. although I would argue to see Star Trek Into Darkness, you had to check your brain at the door or check if you had a brain.
And the story really presents not just some moral dilemmas at the end, but, you know, throughout the middle section of the movie, the crew doesn't know what's going on. They don't know what V'ger is. You know, they're doing what they do, which is exploring a strange being and trying to solve a mystery.
Yeah.
And that at its heart is what the movie is about. That's the driving crux of the plot is Kirk and crew trying to solve this mystery. And once they start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, then they're kind of confronted with this moral dilemma of, okay, the children have come back. How do we fix this?
Yeah. And I think that over time and with reflection, this one has become, and in the director's cut version, this one has become my favorite. And I know that Bobby Polite, who's on here last week on our last episode talking about 2013 movies, he feels the same way, because when I mentioned we were going to talk about these movies, he said, well, I guess nobody's going to stick up for the first one. And I said, you mean the best one? And he went, oh, you like it too? So there are people out there who do have a special place in their hearts for that movie. And I think it holds up. It's got its flaws, but it is a fascinating story, and it's beautiful to watch. I mean, if you like science fiction, actual science fiction where people think their way out of the problem, you know, and I think the Enterprise deserves a nice little 3 or 4 minute. It seems like an hour, I know, but 3 or 4 minute, you know, loving made love to by the camera trip around it, where Scotty's like, and look at this side, and look at this side, you know, and Kirk's like, oh yeah, baby, there's my wife, the Enterprise, you know. Yeah, I mean, I think it totally holds up, and it's worth it, and I really, really have a soft spot for it.
I always like to say it's the most Star Trek.
Yeah.
Of all the Star Trek movies.
Yeah. And the human adventure is just beginning, as it says. I love that. It even has a more upbeat music than the later movies, which is kind of interesting considering you'd think it had the slowest music, but it has the theme music that later went on to be the Next Generation TV show theme music, which is, I think, telling as well, because the Next Generation was much more like this, I think, than it was like Wrath of Khan or any of those others. So, all right, well, let's transition on to the probably most people's favorite of the six, right? Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Beyond the darkness, beyond the human evolution, is Khan, a genetically superior tyrant. Exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up. There she is!
Not enough against their shields.
The base is starboard.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me. Marooned for all eternity. Buried alive.
Sean! Sean!
At the end of the universe lies the beginning of vengeance. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Now, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, it had the advantage of following the one that was seen as a disappointment. And so it basically does everything the opposite of Star Trek, the motion picture. Like, you know, they change the uniforms to be more military and less, you know, ephemeral science. They blow giant holes in the Enterprise. People get bloody and die. I mean, anything that you could say, you know, was too sweet and nice about the first one, the second one was like a ball peen hammer to the skull. So, you know, originally this one was called The Vengeance of Khan. This is one of those funny little science fiction movie stories that maybe not everybody knows. I'm sure you know the deal, right, about why the name was changed and why that sort of ended up being ironic.
I've heard like two or three different things about it.
Okay.
But the one that I've heard the most is the fact that they were trying to, it had to do with Star Wars.
Yes.
That's what I've heard, because the third Star Wars movie was going to be Revenge of the Jedi.
Yes.
And so they didn't want it to be too closely tied to that. And then of course, George Lucas decided that the Jedi could not get revenge. So he changed the name of Jedi to Return.
So neither movie has the word revenge or vengeance.
Exactly.
In it. Yeah, it's The Wrath of Khan and The Return of the Jedi, and neither one of them is what they were originally supposed to be. So they could have left it. But I think Wrath of Khan has a better ring to it anyway. I think it sounds better than Vengeance of Khan.
Oh, so do I.
So Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. The other thing, now, we didn't touch on this, but Star Trek, the motion picture, basically came out a decade after the show ended. But it pretended to be like 2 years after the show ended. They had just ended the 5-year mission and were back on Earth refurbishing and refitting the Enterprise.
Right.
Now, Star Trek II said, screw that, it's been years, and they're old. Which I thought was a good move, because you no longer have to like pretend that these aging actors are still living in the equivalent of 1973 or something, you know, after the after the show ended in 69. So yeah, they jump way ahead so that the actors look the right age, including, gosh, Ricardo Montalban. Either it's been a few years, or life on SETI Alpha 6 or whatever is even worse than you thought it was as far as how he looks. Because he got Phyllis Diller's hair, you know, somewhere along the way. But, Star Trek II, how would you describe this movie sort of in general?
Well, like you said at the beginning, they had the Monday morning quarterback mentality, which is, let's look at everything we did wrong with the first one and fix it with this one. And so, you know, it's the complete opposite, because it is all about, you know, an action oriented plot and, you know, having a bunch of space battles in the middle of it. So I always tell everybody it's the Star Wars version of Star Trek, because you've got heroes fighting villains instead of heroes exploring the galaxy.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. It's more of a pulp action story about revenge and old grudges and stuff. And
they were very smart, though. And I mean, give credit where credit's due, because, you know, when they decided after Star Trek the Motion Picture that they didn't want Gene Roddenberry involved in the franchise anymore, and they brought Harv Bennett in to produce the movies, and he decided that he wanted Nicholas Meyer to come in and write and direct the second one. And they both made some very shrewd decisions storytelling wise.
Yeah.
You know, like you said earlier, the biggest one was, let's not ignore the fact that William Shatner is getting older. And there's a great story where Harv Bennett had to go to Shatner's house and basically explain to him why they were going this route. And, you know, I don't know that a lot of people know, William Shatner, when he was younger, did Judgment at Nuremberg mm-hmm. with Spencer Tracy. And he played basically Spencer Tracy's assistant. And, you know, it was towards the end of Spencer Tracy's career. And Harve Bennett said, you know, Spencer Tracy kind of aged gracefully over his career. And he got to the point where there was like a gravitas to him in the last years of his life when he played these roles. And I kind of see that happening to you. And he like totally played to Shatner's ego.
Yeah.
And said, you know, yeah, you're going to be playing an older Kirk, but there's a way we can do it where you kind of like wink and nod to the audience and say, yeah, I know I'm getting older and I can't go around, as Bones says in Star Trek II, I can't go around hopping galaxies forever, but at least you can be an older Kirk and we can put you in situations that make sense for Kirk to be in at that age. And so I think that was a big thing. And then also the fact that they went back to some of the best Treks that kind of had literary antecedents, and, you know, they really played up the vengeance angle and made it very much like Moby Dick. And there's several allusions to Moby Dick throughout the movie. But I think taking those two tacks at the very beginning made this a much more interesting movie than just a standard, you know, shoot 'em up out in space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, they, like I said, they changed the uniforms, which I think just the visuals to a lot of people matter. They had the crew members doing stuff. They actually they continued that trend of bringing in new people, right? They had brought in Persis Kambada as Lieutenant Ilea in Star Trek the Motion Picture, who sadly passed away a few years after that. She's been gone for quite some time, and she was sort of the antecedent to Troy, Deanna. Yeah. Troy, I think. And they had Captain Decker, who was the son of Commodore Decker from the
Doomsday Machine.
The Doomsday Machine, yeah, the big ham hock that blows everything up, yeah.
Yep.
So that was kind of cool to link it back to that episode, and then of course Khan links it back to the Space Seed episode. I think that Nicholas Meyer's direction and Harvey Bennett's work on it. You had James Horner's music. I mean, they really had some really good people working on this movie that kind of boosted it. Now, it's interesting that this movie did not make as much money as Star Trek the Motion Picture, because it was a much smaller, less splashy movie. When Star Trek the Motion Picture came out, you know, Paramount hailed it like it was, you know, an epical event, you know, something for the ages, which I think all that hype and bringing it back after 10 years brought it a certain amount of business, but not what they'd hoped. This movie was very quietly released, not a lot of hype. Like I said, I didn't even know about it till the movie poster was on the wall, and it made less than $100 million, but in 1982 that was still a success. The difference is the first one cost a bajillion dollars. They made Star Trek II for like $17.50.
Yeah, and I think this is the opening for me to point out, because I think as we go through the movies, this was the one that Paramount kind of figured out the formula a little bit.
Yeah.
And they realized what they had, because again, this was before Star Trek became like a multi-billion dollar franchise for them. But I think they knew if we control costs on the budget and we don't spend a gazillion dollars on these movies, we can release it. It's going to make, you know, anywhere between $70 and $80 million at the box office. We're going to make some money on the back end, and everybody can go home happy. And we'll just crank out, you know, a Star Trek movie every once in a while. And this was kind of the test for that, was can we scale down the budget and still have it look cool, still have it be Star Trek, and, you know, see what kind of audience we're going to get for this.
Yeah, I mean, they did things like they used some of the same sets. They, I love how they just turned the space station from the first movie upside down and pretended it was smaller, and it became the space station.
Well, and that's what's weird is that normally, you know, back then they didn't save stuff like that for very long. Mm-hmm. So somebody at Paramount was very smart to keep the sets, to keep the costumes, to keep all the models, and in hopes that they were going to do another one of these.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think there was a very narrow window where had they not made Star Trek II when they did, then it may not have become the big phenomenon that it ended up becoming, because they wouldn't have had all that stuff to save costs.
Yeah, it's generally credited with saving the entire franchise overall. Because after Star Trek the Motion Picture, if they had just said, well, screw it, we're not going to do this again, then you might not have gotten the Next Generation and all the stuff that came after that. So all the way up till the present day. I mean, eventually they would have brought it back, I think, because they're looking for anything to remake now. But Lord help us, they could have brought it back as a comedy like they have everything else from that era lately, you know? So
right, exactly. And I think that's where they were smart, because instead of saying, well, we need to throw more money at this,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we need to make it bigger and, you know, more epic than the first one, they were very smart and they scaled it back, and it made it, the economics of it made it feasible for them to just crank these out.
I mean, you got to love, they even have the two enemy ships against each other are both Federation ships, so you don't even need but like one interior.
Exactly.
They didn't even have to build a bridge for an enemy ship. It's a Federation ship.
And when they redesigned the bridge of the Enterprise for the second one, they realized that they had kind of like these modular walls, mm-hmm. so they could just put them together in whatever configuration they wanted. So even though the Reliant still looks similar to the Enterprise, some of the turbo lift doors are in different places and some of the consoles are in different places, but it's still the same consoles for both ships. It cracks me up.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. So that one did so well, and relatively speaking, and the first one was all, I mean, again, there's so much to love about the first one, honestly, but, and it is very deeply cosmic and almost like a Jack Kirby-ish way, with the whole V'ger at the end merging with the two humans, or the human and the Deltan, whatever. And, you know, and there's a lot that's emotional and all to that, but the emotion of Star Trek II is so much more, I guess, real in a way, because it's about the sacrifice of Spock. We can't talk about Star Trek II and not talk about, you know, the great sacrifice, which in their wisdom, the screenwriters set up the entire movie. It wasn't just thrown at you and suddenly at the end, you know, like right. certain other movies. It had been set up over, you know, years of developing these characters through TV shows and movies. And you get that great moment with Spock sacrificing himself, the needs of the, because he had been playing all along with the whole idea of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, you know, and later they're going to revisit that when they revive him, with the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many, you know. And
well, and this is really, and when we do the second part in the second show, mm-hmm. When we get to Star Trek VI, I'm going to bring this up again, because Star Trek II is the first time I think we ever see Spock as truly whole. You know, throughout the entire, you know, three seasons of the TV show, you know, there was the constant battle between, you know, his human side and his Vulcan side. You know, they play that up a lot. And that's a big deal in the motion picture,
mm-hmm.
because he had been going through the Kolinar discipline to totally wipe out all emotion from him. And he left that to come back and help the Enterprise with V'ger. And at the end of the movie, they have the line from Scotty where he says, you know, he can get him back to Vulcan, and Spock says, my business there is concluded. So there's a true moment at the end of the motion picture where Spock is kind of like, okay, this whole experience with V'ger has kind of centered him. And the first time we see a truly whole centered Spock is in Star Trek II. And what happens? He throws Vulcan logic out the window and sacrifices himself
mm-hmm.
at the end, because he knows that it's the emotional thing to do, not just the logical thing to do, because those are his friends. And, you know, I love Spock the most in Star Trek II, because it seems like that's the most complete version of Spock that we've gotten up to that point.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I remember thinking at the time when I watched the first one that we'd waited, you know, years to see more Star Trek, to see new Star Trek, and to see Kirk and Spock and McCoy and their little their antics again. And then we get this Spock for 90% of that movie that is not the Spock we know. And so it's interesting in terms of a story that they made him that way. But in terms of bringing back a beloved character and getting to have more of him, you really get ripped off by the first Star Trek movie. Now, again, it's different in retrospect because now we've got all the movies that came after it, and he's even been in the last two of the new ones, right, of the Abrams. So we've gotten lots more Spock after that. But at the time.
Yeah. And the second one, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why people enjoy the second one.
Yeah.
More than the first one at the time was because it was back to the relationships from the series.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't a different experience for us. I mean, we got to see several conversations between Kirk and Spock and McCoy that were very, you know, thought provoking, and they were discussing the morality of the Genesis device, and you got to see McCoy and Spock go at it with each other and Kirk kind of referee. And, you know, there was lots of humor to be made from those situations as well as some drama, but we really got to see these characters be themselves as we remembered them from the show more so than the first movie.
Yeah. I think that for all that stands out visually and energetically about the second one, it's the characters in the second one that really make that movie memorable and lovable. Just the character stuff, the interactions, all the way across the board from Shatner and the other two to Ricardo Montalban and everything. I mean, you don't get anything like that in the first one. You get different things that are good in the first one, but you don't get, there are a few scenes here and there in the first one, like Kirk talking to McCoy about, I need you, Bones, you know, come back aboard and all that. And Kirk trying to get Spock to loosen up, but nothing like you get in two. So,
well, and it's the difference for me. And I point this out in classes all the time that I'm much more a fan personally of character driven stories than stories that are more plot driven, where the characters are just kind of at the mercy of the events around them. And Star Trek II is a perfect example of that because it's all character driven. I mean, even the revenge plot is because of Khan's character and who he is and what he's been through for the last 15 years before they find him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I love all of the characters and even the new ones. I mean, it's great when they bring in Carol Marcus and David, and it's great at the beginning when you see Savick and she goes through the adventure with them. I mean, all of the characters, new and old, all kind of like fit together perfectly in this movie.
Yeah. And so I had mentioned that they brought in new characters and I had stopped with the first one, but yeah, in the second one you get Kirstie Alley's Savick and you get David, who is, and Carol Marcus. You know, David is Kirk's son and Carol Marcus is one-time girlfriend sort of from the past. And now if we can sort of bring in, we can continue referring back to all three now, we can go ahead and bring in Star Trek III as we kind of move toward the last bit of this episode.
All that they've loved, all that they've fought for, all that they've stood for will now be put to the test. Star Trek III, the search for Spock.
The word, sir?
The word?
Is no. I am therefore going anyway.
You do this, you'll never sit in the captain's chair again.
Engage all the systems.
Clear all moorings.
Cleared, sir.
One quarter impulse power.
Someone is stealing the Enterprise.
Warp speed.
Klingon bird of prey, sir. She's arming torpedoes.
Shields up.
The shield's non-responsive.
Fire!
We're a sitting duck.
Join us on this, the final voyage of the Starship Enterprise. Star Trek III, A Search for Spock. The adventure continues. Rated PG.
Star Trek III, The Search for Spock was a very interesting movie because it's a movie that didn't have to happen in a way, right? It's like Star Trek II could have just been the ending you know, Spock sacrificed himself to save everybody else. The end. Amen. Star Trek 3 says, no, it's not over because Spock's not done. We're going to bring him back. And what Star Trek 3 does is basically demand Star Trek 4. So it's kind of like we get part one of two of the sequel to Star Trek 2. Does that, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, and I think once they move forward with Star Trek 3, because, you know, like we've talked about with the first two, I mean, 3 was not a guarantee.
Right.
I mean, they had to wait to make a decision about whether they were going to do a third one. And then once the decision's made, okay, we're going to do a third one. How are we going to do it? Are we going to go forward without Spock? Are we going to try and convince Nimoy to come back? And, you know, how are we going to do it? I mean, it's the thing I always love is, you know, when you have a conversation about continuing a science fiction franchise of any kind, where a character dies or a planet's destroyed or something happens, it's science fiction. You can figure out a way to reverse that if you want to. You know, it's, I know we've had comic book conversations where, you know, for the longest time there was a difference between whether a character was dead or whether they were Bucky dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, now Bucky's back. So, I mean, you can do anything if you want. I hope I didn't spoil it for anybody that Bucky is not dead anymore.
They'll find out soon enough.
Yeah, they're going to find out on May 4th. But in this case, you know, like you said, I mean, they didn't have to do this movie the way they did it. And it was all dependent on whether Nimoy wanted to come back or not. And I love the behind the scenes maneuvering that they kind of had to throw him a bone and let him direct the third one.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only way that they could get him to come back. And, but I do love the third one for what it is, because it's completely dependent on the characters doing something, sacrificing everything that they have for their shipmate, for their friend. Mm-hmm. And it's, to me, it's the most emotional of the six because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it continues this idea that it's all about these characters. I mean, what they really had to learn that they didn't fully understand until I think now at that point is that it's not, you know, you have this science fictional universe that they've created, and you have the Federation, and you have the Klingons, and all that kind of stuff. But what really has to work for the whole thing for anybody to care about it is the characters and their relationships. And so, this movie is almost entirely that. The plot, such as it is, beyond just saving Spock, is paper thin.
Oh, exactly.
Otherwise, it's all just the characters doing what they have to do, sacrificing what they have to sacrifice. But that's not so much plot as just character motivation.
And I love the idea that there were people sitting in a room and they said, okay, we're going to make this movie and they're going to go get Spock. What else happens? Like, that's not a 90-minute movie. Like,
right.
We have to have something else. Well, is there somebody they could fight? I mean, maybe could we think of somebody? Oh, you know who we haven't had them fight? The Klingons. Okay. Let's have them fight a Klingon. How could the Klingons be involved? And I just imagine that's how the story sessions for this movie went, that it was basically all just window dressing for this idea of we have to get from point A to point B so that they can save Spock. Mm-hmm. And there has to be some action in between, because it can't just be them hopping in a ship and going to the Genesis planet.
Yeah. And it couldn't be the Vulcans doing something, cause that doesn't work. So you're exactly right. I mean, they hadn't used the Klingons. The last time we had really seen the Klingons was getting eaten by V'ger at the very beginning of the first movie. And that was kind of an ignominious beginning and end to them, right? So by Star Trek 3, people are kind of like, whatever happened to the Klingons, right? I mean, did V'ger eat the whole planet?
Right.
Are the Klingons little sparkly CGI guys now, you know, or what? So yeah, I mean, that was the logical thing to do, but it does feel sort of shoehorned in. They could have called this Star Trek 3 Force 10 from Klingon Homeworld, because when Mark Buskett and I talked about the Alistair MacLean movies, we were pointing out how The characters from from the Guns of Navarone reappear in Force 10 from Navarone. And I was like, why is it Force 10? And I was like, oh my God, it's because they were forced in from Navarone. And so the Klingons are kind of forced in from this movie to this movie. Well,
and I've always wondered why they didn't use, you know, one of the Klingons from the series.
Yeah.
You know, I could never figure out why they decided to go the route of making it a Klingon we had never seen before to where it would be forced.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had conversations with people at conventions and, you know, just casually where I've said, how much more powerful would the Klingons being on that planet have been if it had been, you know, Michael Ansara playing the Klingon.
Michael Ansara.
Or if they had gotten John Colicos to come back and play Kor. I mean, if it had been somebody that Kirk had history with.
Yeah.
And they were coming into it as, I'm a Klingon. I'm stealing this. You guys are screwing us over. We're not going to let you wipe us out. It would have been, you know, even more emotional.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would have carried over from what they did right with Star Trek II, which was mining the best parts of the series and adding action to it to kind of give you the best of both worlds.
I got to call a timeout here because I'm going to point something out to you. I was just doing a little research while we were talking. Would you like to know what the budget was for the first three movies? I think the audience would like to hear this. And again, this is early 80s movies.
Yeah, I actually looked this up the other day, but I think you've got the exact figure in front of you.
The budget for the first movie in the late 70s, it was made in like 77, 78, 79. The budget for the first movie was $46 million. The budget for the second movie was $11 million, 3 years later.
Yeah.
Okay, and the budget for the third movie, because inflation had kicked in, was $16 million. So the first movie cost more than like 2, 3, and 4 put together.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
And that's where, you know, there were bean counters at Paramount that were really smart and said, you know, if we keep costs down on this, we can make a lot of money. Now, I will tell you, because we didn't touch on this, you know, you said earlier that your first inkling that they were doing Star Trek II was, you know, seeing the advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
My first inkling of seeing Star Trek III and knowing that they were doing that was, I can vividly remember the first night that my parents had bought Trivial Pursuit because we decided we were going to play it. And we had like this mammoth marathon Trivial Pursuit session and we had the TV on in the background and we actually had MTV on just so we had music. Back when MTV played music all the time.
Yeah, crazy.
Yeah, how crazy is that? But I vividly remember seeing over my dad's shoulder a commercial for Star Trek III. And in 30 seconds, it blew my mind because I saw the crew of the Enterprise out of uniform. You know, they were all wearing various civilian costumes, except for Scotty. Which, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, why are they out of uniform, but Scotty's still in uniform? I don't know what's going on there. I saw the Klingons. I saw, you know, various cool special effects of the Genesis planet exploding. And I saw the Excelsior.
Mm-hmm.
And my mind, you know, almost blew because I was like, what is that? That ship's bigger than the Enterprise. It looks cooler. It's sleeker. It's curvier. Are they getting a new ship? Is that a different ship? I don't know what's going on. But in like 30 seconds, it got me really jazzed about this movie because there was so much and I didn't know what was going on. I was like, they have to go look for Spock. You know, what's going on? So I remember at the time being really excited about it and going and, you know, I always tell people, you know, people have movies that they consider the best movies they've seen. And then they have like sentimental favorites and Star Trek III for me out of the six original series movies is kind of like my sentimental favorite because it's all about friendship. It's all about, you know, the crew doing something for their comrade And really, it's the first time that we see them as all of them as characters. I mean, everybody kind of has a little moment. You know, Sulu's got a little thing. Chekhov gets a little moment. You know, Scotty gets a couple of, you know, key things because he gets to sabotage the Excelsior. You know, he gets to set up the Enterprise so they can fly it by themselves without a crew. Uhura gets a big moment when she has to, like, commandeer the transporter station to get them to the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of little things. And McCoy's a really big part of it, too, because he's carrying Spock's Katra. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of humor to be mined from that. But it was really the first time that they said, okay, we're going to let all of them kind of be an ensemble. It's not just going to be about Kirk and Spock and McCoy. And I really liked that.
That's a very good point. Absolutely. It is like the first one where they all sort of get lots of stuff to do, or at least something important along the way, each of them to some degree.
Exactly.
Like that. Yeah.
And it kind of fits in with the Force 10 from Navarone, Guns of Navarone mm-hmm. comparison, because it really is kind of like that mission sort of a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And it even sets them at odds with the Federation, which they've been happily members of all the way up until this point. So,
and you know, that's another point, because, you know, I'm sure at some point we're going to have to complete the trilogy and talk about the Next Generation movies. Mm. And then the Next Generation kind of played with that over the years, too. But when Kirk is confronted with going against the Federation, going against Starfleet, losing his career, or trying what he can to save not just Spock, but McCoy as well, mm-hmm. There's not a second thought in his mind.
Right.
And I love the scene where he's meeting with the commander of Starfleet. And, you know, the guy basically tells him, no, it's out of the question. I'm not going to give you the Enterprise. You can't get another ship. You know, the Genesis planet's quarantined. Nobody goes there. And Kirk just says, okay, you're right. You know, I had to ask. And then he gets up, and when he goes to the turbo lift, the rest of the crew's waiting for him. And Sulu even says, you know, what's the word? And he says the words, no, therefore I'm going anyway.
Yeah.
Like, there's no hesitation on his part.
That's right.
I mean, he knew when he sat down for the conversation, if they told me no, I'm going anyway. I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going.
Yeah.
And I just love from that point on, because he's very single-minded of purpose that – you know, it's not about Starfleet. It's not about the Federation. It's not about the Prime Directive. I'm doing what I need to do for my best friends.
Yeah, and it is a powerful, emotional, character-driven story, and it's very good. Well, let us bring this first segment to a close. I want to get a quick sort of reaction to each of the three from you, and then we're going to wrap things up, and we'll... And then on our next episode, we'll come back and hit 4, 5, and 6. So you're sort of a letter grade, A-, B+, D, F, whatever. Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Star Trek the Motion Picture now is...
Yeah, we're going to talk about totally now.
I think it's a solid B+.
Okay.
I mean, there's a lot that I would do differently, or I wish they had done differently. But I think as far as a Star Trek movie, it's a solid B+.
I'm going to give Star Trek the Motion Picture now in the director's cut an A-. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Wrath of Khan. Okay. I, just because of how I feel about the movie, the fact that I love James Horner's music in it, and the direction it kind of set the rest of the franchise on, I'm going to say that is an A- movie for me.
Originally for me, for many years, it was an A+. And now I'm going to say it hasn't worn as well for me. It's an A-. And I like the motion picture marginally more. Star Trek III: Search for Spock.
Star Trek III: Search for Spock, I'm going to give a B, just because, you know, there's stuff that clearly is just there to be there and pad out the movie. But I really like the characters in that movie. And I really love it for sentimental reasons more than anything. So I'm going to give it a B.
Yeah, I think B to B-, somewhere in that range. Christopher Lloyd is okay, but he's as much distracting as he is entertaining to me. And since he carries the entire plot aside from the character motivations, that's kind of tough. So B to B minus for Search for Spock. All right, Jim, let's wrap this episode up today. Make sure folks go out and check out Jim's stuff. What would be the main thing right now you'd be pushing on the audience that they should check out? Because
we're actually getting ready to reboot the website because I know you've probably seen it on Facebook, but coming up in a couple of months is the 15th anniversary. It's weird for me to say that.
Yeah.
Of the Swindlers of Doom, which is our big science fiction, you know, space opera epic that we did as a radio drama 15 years ago. So we're actually getting ready to re-record that.
Oh, awesome. Fantastic.
With new music and a new full cast audio drama. That's coming out in a couple of months. The book's going to be re-released as an anniversary edition. So that is at midnight-entertainment.com, and it will all be relaunched here pretty soon.
And I totally love that and can't wait to hear it. I've read the book, love it. Can't wait to hear the audio. That's fantastic. All right. And I would just say, for my part, you folks probably know the Sentinels. Check out the latest cool thing is that my military science fiction series called The Shattering, Volume 1, which is called Legion 1 Lords of Fire, is a finalist for the Pulp Factory Awards for Novel of the Year. I'm just very excited about that.
You should be.
I hope it wins. I'll be at the ceremony in Chicago in April. We'll see what happens. It's going up against a Doc Savage novel and a Sherlock Holmes novel, so I don't know. You know, just because it's going up against established properties, if no other reason, it'll be tough, but very excited. So, yeah, check out Lords of Fire. It's on Kindle. It's in paperback. All right. The Rocket's going to take a refueling break here, and we will see you folks in our next episode talking about 4, 5, and 6. Thanks a bunch, Jim.
Thank you.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.